from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Another awful weekend in Iraq. More U.S. dead and 50 newly trained Iraqi soldiers killed execution style in one ambush at a fake checkpoint. Plus, reports of 380 tons of high explosives missing from a key Iraqi arms dump that was supposed to be under U.S. control. The war keeps coming, and whether you were for it or against it at the start, the challenges in Iraq can look pretty chilling today. President Bush calls it important, hard work. John Kerry calls it a mismanaged mess. Whoever wins next Tuesday, it is a crisis that will not be easily solved. But Americans have to make a choice in the voting booth, and Iraq is at the heart of it. Tonight on Point, the Iraq War and America's Choice on November 2nd. We begin tonight with a look at how the war in Iraq is shaping the thinking of American voters. Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press in Washington, D.C. Earlier, I asked him how polls indicate Iraq is playing for George Bush and John Kerry.
Well, the American public continues to be divided about whether this was the right decision, whether going to war was the right thing to do. And at the same time, the public is very critical of President Bush. His approval ratings in our poll, at least, are just about at the 40% level, which is very, very poor. Yet, when we ask people, who do you have the most confidence in to deal with the issue of Iraq going forward, we have a small plurality continuing to say President Bush and not John Kerry.
Now, how do you interpret that from your poll numbers? John Kerry, of course, says that President Bush has misled, miscalculated, mismanaged every aspect of this undertaking, his quote from the campaign trail. So in the poll numbers, how do you interpret the continuing support for President Bush to do a better job?
Well, I think it reflects two things, probably more general confidence in President Bush's leadership on international issues, and secondly, the fact that Senator Kerry has not clearly distinguished himself from President Bush on the issue of Iraq, even though he's made so much of it recently and made so much of it in the debates talking about the wrong war at the wrong time and so on. But, you know, the initial impressions were, I think, somewhat confusing to people, and that confusion still reigns. Now, Iraq continues to be one of the top issues for people. Iraq, the economy, the war on terrorism, health care, they're all bunched up there. And people who put their emphasis on Iraq tend to be more supportive of Senator Kerry. But on the other hand, if you ask a question flat out, who do you trust more, it's still the president.
And what about skepticism or criticism of how the White House has handled the war effort? How have you seen that change in the months since the spring of 2003 when the invasion took place?
Well, we saw strong support for the president through much of the second half of 2003, and then it got even stronger after the capture of Saddam Hussein. But then with the Shiite revolt, the horrible things that happened in Fallujah, the Abu Ghraib scandal, President Bush really took it on the chin with respect to Iraq, and it led to an overall decline in his approval ratings. At the beginning of this year, the president's approval ratings were in the mid-50s, in the low 50s to mid-50s. They haven't really been there for much of this time since things went bad in Iraq. Now, there was a period after the Republican convention in September where his approval ratings overall and his handling of the perceptions of his handling in Iraq improved. But that's since dissipated, in part because of the campaign, because of the debates, and I would say in part because there's so much bad news coming out of Iraq.
And what about that drumbeat of bad news? And, of course, more just in the past few days, the 50 dead Iraqi police killed by insurgents, these tons and tons of high explosives apparently not monitored and on the loose now, a top army official calling for an investigation into Halliburton's contracts. Do you see this coming specifically into play on people's perceptions of the war? Does it just factor into the president's overall approval ratings? How does it show up?
Well, the American public, you know, hasn't changed its view since it soured on the war. It continues to be divided on the war, and there's a great partisan divide with 75-80% of Republicans favoring the war and only 20% or so or less of Democrats and independents falling somewhere in the middle. And that really hasn't changed. What also hasn't changed is there's not a great disposition to take our troops out of there. We still have 6 in 10 saying, close to 6 in 10 saying, we've got to stay the course until the situation stabilizes. I think the public is just becomes more despondent about it. In this latest poll, the one we conducted last week, we even saw some decline in the percentage of people saying they were paying close attention to news about Iraq. It's still a very high top news subject. But I think people begin to look a little past it because they feel frustrated about what's happening there.
So as a pollster, Andy Kohut, how do you see it? Would you describe next Tuesday's election as hinging on the war, or are you saying that voters have find it so flummoxing that they're discounting it and looking away?
I'm of this view. I think if this vote was only about domestic issues, Senator Kerry would win. If it were only about the war on terrorism, I think President Bush would win. In many respects, the war in Iraq is the trump card. And I think if the public is focused on the war in Iraq, it will raise their criticisms of President Bush, and that might tip it to Senator Kerry. On the other hand, if their concerns are about the war on terrorism or the concerns about whether Senator Kerry is a strong enough leader or whether he changes his mind too much, I think it might push it the other way.
Andy Kohut, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Andrew Kohut is director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. He spoke with us from Washington. We are talking tonight about the war in Iraq and America's choice on November 2nd, next Tuesday. Should George Bush be reelected for the war effort or chased out of the White House for that effort? And who do you trust now, Kerry or Bush, to best steer the country through the remainder of the war, whatever that may mean? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Ossining, New York, is Peter Boyer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's author of the article, The Believer, Paul Wolfowitz Defends His War, in this week's New Yorker. Peter Boyer, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you this evening.
And I should point out, as we begin to speak, that The New Yorker, your magazine, has, I guess just this week, for the first time ever, endorsed a candidate this year for the presidency. It's not George Bush. It's John Kerry. So some precedent set there in the background by your editors as you've been out reporting.
Yes, it would it would have been newsworthy, would it not, had it been George Bush.
Sure would.
I suppose it's not the choice is not entirely surprising. It's a little bit of a surprise that the magazine that the editors chose to do it this year, when you think of all of that long history, 79 years, that a lot has happened. A lot of presidents have come and gone, including Nixon twice, that didn't warrant an endorsement. And this year, obviously, the magazine feels enough is at stake to weigh in.
Peter Boyer, we've asked you on tonight because you've just got this profile coming out of Paul Wolfowitz. You've spent some real time with him in the States and overseas.
Yes.
He is, of course, one of the key, maybe the key architect of the war in Iraq. As voters think about what's happened there and what might happen in the next under the next administration, whatever that may be, if it's a Bush administration, it could very well be influenced heavily again by Paul Wolfowitz. So help us understand what you see him thinking about how this war has gone and how it ought to or might well go in the months and years ahead.
I think that Paul Wolfowitz would very likely agree that it is not going well, and I think that he would concede, probably not publicly, 8 days before the election, but I think that he would concede that there was one very big, very important miscalculation at the outset, and that has, to some large degree, pretty much determined everything else that has come after. And that big miscalculation was the idea that the enemy would recognize defeat at the hands of this mighty American military and submit. That didn't happen, and the American-led coalition was very slow in recognizing it, and in recognizing that there was an insurgency there. And by the time a response began to be formed, it was certainly too late to nip an insurgency in the bud. And you could make the argument that it is only just now being undertaken.
And you point out that fundamental misjudgment here. And then a second one, the calculation that putting an Iraqi face on the mission would defuse the insurgency, that also has not happened.
Yes.
And then you come to a third, which is Paul Wolfowitz's look ahead. And I guess this is what voters ought to be thinking about in part when they make their vote. The next being that in the next 6 months or a year, pushing more weight or responsibility onto Iraqi security forces, they can be strong enough to allow American forces to recede. If he's misjudged the first two, what are the odds that he's right on the third?
Well, that's a very good question. It is easy to see how the second calculation, that is, putting an Iraqi face on it, or put another way, giving the country sovereignty, made sense. You can also see how that in and of itself would not stop the violence. Indeed, it hasn't. Indeed, you can make the argument that if anything, it's accelerated it.
Yeah.
Wolfowitz would say, well, that's because the terrorists and the insurgents are the more desperate to stop freedom and hinder the elections and so on, and therefore they've stepped it up. Well, be that as it may, it's a mess, and sovereignty, the transfer, the folding up of the CPA, Paul Bremer, and the stepping back of America did not stop the violence. The only exit strategy that has been articulated and is being articulated is the Iraqification, if you will, of the war, and there are a lot of components to it, not least being that a sovereign Iraqi government on its way to having a fully independent, after the first round of elections happen, presumably in January, will be able to address the insurgency in ways that the American-led coalition simply cannot witness Fallujah last spring.
Right.
And that is the hope.
There's the hope, but for voters thinking about their vote next Tuesday, if they haven't decided already, do you see any fundamental change in the impulse of this administration toward Iraq? You know, there's little signals being sent out. Well, there's a kind of moderation going on here. We're going to do things differently. Paul Wolfowitz is the generator of a lot of worldview here. Do you see him having changed his fundamental view of the world?
No, I don't. Well, certainly in terms of emphasis and tone. Obviously, on March 17th, before the war, March 17th, 2003.
Yeah.
He might have spoken about the prospect of a stable and liberalized and even democratic Middle East in more sanguine terms than he would today.
Much more modest on that front.
That's exactly right. In fact, modest is precisely the term that he used when we talked about that. He says, what he hopes for now is something basically stable and more liberal than what came before. He says the model of he would happily settle for a Romanian style democracy, which is, of course, not what one would have hoped for, I suppose, before the war started, but it's certainly better than what came before, and certainly better than what's there now.
All this for Romanian style democracy, but the fundamental view, which you say he so intimately shares with George Bush, is this kind of evil versus good, worship of death versus love of life view of the world. That goes on as the core touchstone.
I think that it does. It's kind of impressive in a way, because in this sense, it truly is, I think, a determining force in his thinking. I really do believe and have seen, and we have talked in different. Sir, I've been to Iraq twice with him. I've traveled with him in this country, and we've met in Washington. And I really have been struck by the level of conviction that he still maintains on some of those core assertions. He is much more like the president himself in this almost evangelical zeal, I guess is one way you could put it, for the idea of a democratized Middle East.
And that, we've got to take a short break, but that sounds like more of the same. Peter Boyer with The New Yorker, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War and America's choice on November 2nd. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War and America's choice next Tuesday. You can join the conversation tonight. Should George Bush be reelected for the Iraq War effort or driven out of the White House? Is Bush winning or losing in Iraq? Is the Iraq War pushing you into John Kerry's camp? Does Kerry have cleaner hands, a better policy for success? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Peter Boyer of The New Yorker magazine. He's got a new profile out of Paul Wolfowitz, the chief architect of the war in Iraq. We're joined right now from Washington and deep inside the John Kerry camp by James Rubin, foreign policy advisor to the Kerry Edwards campaign, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, served as advisor and spokesperson for Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. James Rubin, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Lots of trouble in Iraq, and both John Kerry and John Edwards pouncing all over George Bush and his handling of that war today. And yet we heard, you may have heard as well, James Rubin, at the top of this hour, Andy Kohut at the Pew Center saying for all their dissatisfaction, the low job rating that George Bush is getting right now, American voters still say in their poll that they trust him more to deal with Iraq. What do you make of that as a big Kerry guy?
Well, I think the idea that it's even as close as it is a testament to the failures of the Bush administration. This is the president is the commander-in-chief. There's a natural tendency of the American public to want to give him that kind of a sense of support. But I think it's also clear that the public has started to catch up with those who have been in Iraq and those who have examined the policies, and they've come to realize that there were some major, major errors of judgment by the Bush administration in launching the war so in such a rush and in failing spectacularly to plan for what comes after the fall of Saddam Hussein, and probably the individual as much responsible for this poor judgment, really naive judgment, is Paul Wolfowitz.
Right there at the president's side. James Rubin, you're at John Kerry's side now. What's the heart of your argument for the American voters' vote next Tuesday around Iraq? Is it mismanagement, looking back and saying it was so poorly handled you can't trust these guys, or is it the forward view that John Kerry has such a different way going forward because the options going forward don't look so, you know, plentiful?
Well, I think it's really both. I think that, if insanity is defined as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, I think the public is going to conclude that the policies and the judgment of this administration in Iraq have proven to be a failure. And to reelect them and have the same policies pursued by the same people is only going to lead to more failure. And John Kerry does bring a fresh start to this and will be able to look at it fresh and really, most importantly, be able to have the rest of the world look at the United States fresh again instead of all the bad will and all the poisoned well of the pre-war situation where people were blaming each other across the Atlantic. In John Kerry's case, he'll be able to go to the rest of the world, the leaders who have not participated, and say, look, you and I don't need to have a discussion whether it was right to launch this war. I made clear it wasn't. But we're now all in the same boat, and your interests mean that you don't want this to fail, and so we have to work together on this. He'll have a far, far better chance of getting the support we need to get the job done.
We're going to hear from supporters of Bush policy later in this hour. But James Rubin, I wish you'd paint two pictures for us then. Again, as a Kerry guy, paint the picture of where you see or fear the future of the Iraq conflict going in a second Bush administration, and then paint the Kerry path ahead in that arena, if you would, so we can understand the contrast, you imagine.
Well, if George Bush is reelected, we're going to have more of the same.
we're going to have an international community, European and other allies around the world, staying as far away from Iraq as they can. We're going to have the United States bearing 90% of the burden, 90% of the cost. And we're going to have the same management of the training of Iraqi forces, the reconstruction, and the planning for a political transition there, a management that has failed. It's 18 months after the fall of Saddam, and we're still fighting pitched battles across the country. Contrast that with a new administration that will be able to reach out to others and, I believe, get substantial support, a new administration that will make the training of Iraqi forces a top priority. The lead trainer, David Petraeus, General Petraeus, isn't getting the support he needs from this administration to train Iraqi forces. You have a reconstruction program that even Republican senators have called incompetent. And John Kerry will come at this with quick impact programs for reconstruction and with reaching out to others in order to get support so we can have these elections in January. And I think that'll give us a far, far better chance of success there.
Jimmy Rubin, is this such a deep hole of a mess now that, honestly, it's only a marginal difference between what two different presidents can produce?
Well, look, John Kerry has made clear he's not going to leave and cut and run or anything like that. It wasn't the war on terrorism when George Bush launched it, but it's certainly part of the war on terrorism today with all the terrorists that are flooded in there. And I think we need to succeed there. And so really the question is the cost of success. In a Kerry administration, we will be in a much better position to limit that cost by getting others to help us share the burden, share the risk, and share the cost.
There you've got it, the Kerry view of Iraq and that war's future. James Rubin, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
James Rubin, foreign policy advisor to the Kerry Edwards campaign. We're looking at the Iraq war and the choice Americans have to make next Tuesday, November 2nd. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. Steve's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm calling. I have a little different perspective. I'm a teacher. I teach in Brooklyn Heights. I watched with my class of fourth graders as the planes slammed into the towers. And we were so traumatized by this that my colleagues and I in the school were looking for someone to blame. And we were conned by Bush. And Bush diverted our blame against the terrorists towards Iraq. And we need Kerry to go in and clean up the mess and then get us out of there.
You're saying you feel conned now. Are you confident that Kerry can do a better job, Steve?
I hope so. I'm confident that Kerry will not stay for the wrong reasons. Bush brought us in there for the wrong reasons, and he diverted the attention away from those that are really guilty and placed it on Iraq.
Steve, we've got it, and thanks for that view from right across the water from the World Trade Center. Peter Boyer, no small number of people who feel that disillusion. I mean, it's hard to feel great about the reality that's coming out of Iraq these days. And Steve's ready to switch horses, yet it's such a complicated scene there. What's your sense in talking with Wolfowitz and listening to people like Jamie Rubin in the Kerry camp about how big a difference Kerry can make, given that he's not talking about cutting and running?
Well, that's a very, very good question, Tom. I tell you, Kerry has one huge advantage right now, which is, and you hinted at it a little bit in your asking Jamie to paint two pictures. Mm. The first picture he paints is the picture of chaos, and that's an easy portrait to draw because we know what chaos looks like. Mm-hmm. It's that ugly picture that materializes every time we turn on the news. He was less precise in drawing the second picture you asked for, which is what will Kerry do. To some degree, this administration obviously will have to answer to the voters for what is seems to be a mess, seems to be a chaotic situation in Iraq. I guess the question for the voters will be exactly what John Kerry would do. I mean, exactly what John Kerry would do differently, and I haven't heard yet what that is. It sounds to me very much when you hear Dick Holbrooke speak, even when you hear Jamie talk, that it would be pretty much the exact same thing. He's not going to cut and run, which means he will do this better. Well, precisely what is this? Is it training troops? Is it, is it exactly what? One has the sense. I mean, Jamie, for example, would know this even better than I, but it is not so simple a matter just to go to, for example, our traditional allies and say, look, we know you weren't with us when it looked like Saddam's regime was going to be a fairly easy thing to topple.
Right.
But now that it's a proven mess, would you please come join us?
Come on in. The water's not fine. But I guess all of that may well lead people to look deeper to the kind of thing that you have Paul Wolfowitz describing, this fundamental worldview of evil versus good, and maybe saying, well, if that was the fundamental view that got us into this, maybe if Kerry doesn't share that, that may produce a fundamental view that can get us out of it.
It may, but I mean, but what is that fundamental view? I think it is probably one that tends toward a more multilateral inclination that is willing to listen to multilateral organizations and so on.
But and that can clearly come with a lot of its own problems. Peter Boyer, stand by. I want to bring a couple more voices in here. Joining us tonight from Washington, Carl Zinnmeister. He is editor-in-chief at the American Enterprise, author of Dawn Over Baghdad, How the U.S. Military is Using Bullets and Ballots to Remake Iraq, and Boots on the Ground, a month with the 82nd Airborne in the battle for Iraq. He was embedded with U.S. troops twice in Iraq. Carl Zinnmeister, thanks for being with us tonight.
Happy to be with you.
Also with us from Washington, David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine, author of The Lies of George W. Bush, Mastering the Politics of Deception. He writes a weblog at davidkorn.com. David Korn, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Carl Zinnmeister, we heard James Rubin carrying the Kerry critique of the Bush administration's performance in Iraq and promoting the Kerry way forward. You've been much more supportive of what's happening in Iraq now and Bush's management of this war. How do you describe the choice that voters have to make next Tuesday?
You know, I think I'd prefer not to focus heavily on electoral politics. That's not really my interest or my expertise. I've spent close to 4 months in Iraq over the last year or so and would like to just talk about what I've seen there and the actual progress of the war. And the main thing I think I would emphasize, if I could, is that, we're in a war. This is a real war, as big and serious a war with stakes as high as our war against Nazism or our war against communism.
A war that we chose to make, and I want to come back to this Nazism comparison, but yeah, please go on.
Yeah, if I may. We are in a real war, and real wars do not end like soccer matches after 18 months. It's important to remember that, for instance, in World War II, we lost an average of 300 men a day for 4 years. That's what happens in a big, serious struggle against a big, serious enemy.
But that is not what was portrayed here, and this is not a big, serious enemy like Hitler's Germany. Please, you don't mean to say that, do you?
I absolutely do. I mean, this is very much a struggle on that scale and of that nature.
The military, that the U.S. military rolled over in a matter of days versus years fighting the Wehrmacht and all the rest?
It's a completely different kind of war. There was never a loss of thousands of U.S. lives on U.S. soil under German hands either. It's a completely different sort of war, but the stakes are just as high in terms of their ability to collapse our economy, their ability to kill thousands of Americans, perhaps hundreds of thousands of Americans, their ability to completely transform the way we live, which I think we are all experiencing right now.
So when you say they, you're conflating or just pulling in together Iraqi resistance and, I guess, global terrorism.
I wasn't aware I was going to be debating the host in this.
No, I just want to clarify there because
I knew I'd be debating the other guest, but this is a little bit of an unusual format. If I may say so, I am saying that the struggle against Muslim extremism did not start with Osama bin Laden. It goes back 25 years at least to the takeover of our embassy in Tehran, and there have been a long series of punctuations since then where you had small events like the Achille Lauro hijacking and big events like Pan Am 103, and this all culminated with the Twin Towers going down, but that was not an isolated event. It was not one experience. This is part of a very large phenomenon, our struggle against fanaticism coming from the Middle East, and it is rooted in the fact, in my opinion, that you have 22 Arab nations and zero decent governments, zero democracies, and until that frightening ratio gets turned around, we will keep getting bitten by very frustrated, homicidally frustrated young men from this part of the world.
What grade would you give the Bush administration's prosecution of the war in Iraq, Carl Zinnmeister?
I would say that this is very much of a work in progress. We're 18 months into it. Are you aware that, for instance, 18 months into the Civil War, you know, Lee had just invaded the North. Washington was ringed. The Federal Army had been smashed in its attempt to march on Richmond. It looked like that cause was lost. Get used to slavery and the separation of the country. 18 months into World War II, we had been completely destroyed in on the European continent. We had been swept out of the Pacific. There were actually Japanese soldiers on American soil in the 18th month of World War II. You know, this is what wars are like. They are hard, they are bitter, they are dirty. That's why we don't take them up lightly. But when we do take them up, we have to understand that there is going to be a long struggle. Let me take, for instance, D-Day, maybe the most heavily planned and carefully thought out military undertaking ever. Every single national resource was at the disposal of those commanders. Do you realize there were 2,500 men killed in 24 hours at D-Day? And many of them in what would, by modern minds, be called screw-ups, you know, failures, the gliders land in the wrong places and so forth. That's the way wars go, and I think we have to have a historical point of view and a little bit more maturity and patience in understanding how they are prosecuted.
All right, we're listening. David Korn, come in here. You've got a different perspective on what's going on.
It strikes me as a bit absurd here. I mean, Carl's talking about this in terms of World War II and so on. The president told us we had to go to war because Iraq posed a threat because of weapons of mass destruction. He didn't say we have to go to war now to have a crusade or a war against Muslim extremism, and this is going to be an 18-month, 36-month, 54-month endeavor. It was to take Saddam out because he claimed he was a direct, immediate, and gathering threat. Those are all quotes from the president.
Yes.
And you have Dick Cheney saying we'd be greeted as liberators. And what Saddam Hussein had to do directly with Muslim extremism is still beyond me. Carl tries to make the point that, you know, there are 22 nations in the Middle East, not one is a democracy, and that to deal with Muslim extremism, we have to, you know, invade countries to deal with that problem. But we picked a country that was not a source of Muslim extremism any more so than many other nations out there, especially if you look at America as the target. So this is really a bait and switch. I can guarantee you, you can look at what was said before the war by this administration, and no one ever talked about D-Day scenarios, five-year war plans, and so on like that. The best president said it would be tough, but you had people like, as I said, Cheney saying we'd be greeted as liberators. You had friends of the administration saying this would be a cakewalk, be over in weeks. We'd get Ahmed Chalabi or somebody else in there. And now we're talking about a multi-year, decades-long, perhaps, war against Muslim extremism. That is what's wrong. And that's what this election should be about, because if that was what this was about, everybody knew about it except the American public, and the president misled them.
Okay, we've got to hear more on this. We've got to take a short break first to get our callers in as well. We are talking about the Iraq War and America's Choice on November 2nd. That is now next Tuesday. We're joined tonight by Peter Boyer of The New Yorker magazine, Carl Zinsmeister, editor-in-chief of The American Enterprise, and David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation. You can join us as well. If you're dismayed by the war but still supporting Bush, tell us why. If you voted for Bush but the war's turned you to Kerry, tell us why there. And if Bush is reelected, what does that affirm in American foreign policy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Iraq War and America's Choice next Tuesday at the polls. You can join the conversation tonight. If John Kerry is elected, what change do you expect in America's global posture in Iraq? Should George Bush have to clean up the mess in Iraq? Is he just the man to do it? Would Kerry do a better job or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from The Nation by David Korn, from The American Enterprise by Carl Zinsmeister, and from The New Yorker magazine by Peter Boyer. Andrew is calling right now from Cold Spring, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I guess I'm calling from my perspective out here in what's a quintessential swing state.
Sure are.
Split pretty evenly as far as I can tell. I'm not a Bush supporter, but I do have acquaintances who are, and I talk to them. And what really strikes me as being odd is that many of these supporters of Bush are sticking to justifications for the war that even the administration has long since abandoned.
What do you make of that, Andrew?
That's a tough call. As if they don't even keep step with the with the current administration, with the person they support. They want unfortunately, a lot of people want a very simplistic answer to some complex questions. They want to believe a simple dualistic world exists, and they're not even going to keep up with their current leader in changing the justifications of this war. They still want a tie between Iraq and 9/11. They want a tie between Iraq and Muslim extremism. They want a tie between Iraq and potential for weapons of mass destruction reaching our shores. And I find it to be very, very disconcerting.
Andrew, thanks for your call. Carl Zinsmeister, jump in here. Andrew points out the administration has changed the focus of its attention, as David Korn points out as well, since we went into Iraq. Do you think some Americans haven't kept up with it?
You know, I can't speak for the administration. I don't care to speak for the administration. I speak as someone who has observed firsthand myself. My own observation is that this is a large effort against a multi-headed beast, which has many aspects. There are all sorts of Muslim extremists. They differ by religion. For instance, let's just take the fact in Iraq alone that the most deadly enemy there, this guy Zarqawi, does not even consider Shiites, who will be the majority population in Iraq, to be Muslims. I mean, he's very explicit on this. He calls them scorpions and infidels. He does not consider Kurds to be Muslims. So the guy who is the main leader of the terrorist insurgency in Iraq has already taken 80% of the population off the table as, you know, legitimate inheritors of the throne. One wonders, you know, how could he possibly be a popular leader? He's not a popular leader. The only thing I'm trying to say is that these are different kinds of enemies that are motivated by different kinds of reasons. What they have in common is that we are the Satan for all of them. We represent the sort of liberal, modern, Western ethic that they hate, that they consider the enemy. And there are ties amongst them loose and strong, and there are many that are at sword points with each other, but that isn't really relevant. What's relevant is that they are all attacking us and that this is a part of the world that needs to be viewed in that sort of grand term.
But it does sound like David Korn used the crusade word. It does sound like a new crusade in exactly the old-fashioned sense of the word, Carl Zinsmeister, as you describe it there. Is that really a great thing for the United States to be getting into?
I don't think it's a crusade at all. I think it's an attempt to defend ourselves against enemies who have made great efforts over 25 years to hurt us badly, many of them successful. It isn't just 911. 911 I think of as the sort of gigantic exclamation point at the end of a very long paragraph. I sat down the other day and came up with about 25 incidents between the fall of the our embassy in Tehran.
Yeah, and we heard some of those. David Korn, I want to get you in here. I hear you there.
Address this point directly, and that is, there's a study that just came out this past weekend at the University of Maryland that took a poll. They asked Bush supporters if there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq before the war. 72% told the pollsters of the University of Maryland they believed that they believe today that there were weapons of mass destruction or weapons of mass destruction programs in Iraq before the war, even though the Dolphin report has come out and said that there weren't. A majority believed that there was a connection between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, even though the CIA and the 9/11 Commission say that there wasn't. A majority believed that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, even though Bush has been forced to say that's not the case. So at some point you have to ask yourself, why is it that these people in such large numbers are holding on to assumptions that are just not true?
And what's your answer? What's your answer, David Korn?
Well, I think it's because if you follow through on the report, the poll, the pollsters asked if these people thought that their views were being confirmed by the Bush administration. And like 80% said yes. They all believe that what their information that they're basing their opinions on is coming from the Bush administration. So I think even though the news is otherwise, there have been all these signals and all this rhetoric used in such a fashion. Even today, the president says that Iraq was a gathering threat. The Dolphin report says that the weapons of mass destruction programs were in a state of decay. They were going in the wrong direction. Gathering means coming together. They were degathering. And that's what I think people are putting their faith in the president to be an honest broker of facts, and they're being misinformed. And I think it's easy to look at Iraq and see it as the terrible Saddam Hussein as even the worst enemy, a worse tyrant than he was, or even more dangerous.
And
Bush is preying upon that.
Peter Boyer, help us out here. You've talked with Paul Wolfowitz recently. Here you've got the chief architect. Do you see Paul Wolfowitz at the center of the Bush administration's policy in Iraq as having been disabused of some of his opening assumptions about Iraq, his opening beliefs, if that's what they were, about weapons of mass destruction and all the rest? Or is he still carrying on that early set of assumptions and beliefs?
No, I don't think he has been disabused of some key assumptions he made, except of those which about which he has no choice, namely weapons of mass destruction. But those weren't assumptions that were particular to him or indeed to the Bush administration.
But they were central to the argument for war.
Yes, they were.
The public argument, anyway.
They were, but in terms of Wolfowitz's view, I mean, I think the thing that was most important to him was this idea, this connect the dot view that there were connections between terrorists and terrorist organizations and Saddam Hussein's regime. I think there's been a lot of evidence to suggest otherwise. I don't think that he necessarily buys it. I do believe that he still, in fact, I've seen him do it repeatedly, draw those connections. And the short answer to your question is no. Such assumptions as that he has not been disabused of.
And he does, like Karol Zinsmeister, as you report him in Poland, he does easily make the kind of comparison between the fight that's going on now and the fight against Hitler's Nazi army.
But, you know, I would like to just say this about what I observed in that regard. It is absolutely true, but I think to Carl's point, I don't think that he or anybody in this administration or elsewhere, for that matter, is saying that Saddam Hussein and his army equaled Hitler's Wehrmacht. I mean, obviously they didn't. But I think what Carl is suggesting, and I think what Wolfowitz would say, and in fact has said, is that the ism here, call it Islamofascism or whatever you want to call it, is like the totalitarianism that was faced down in the 20th century. And it is, and what Iraq is what the president used to call the Battle of Iraq in that larger war.
And that he's sticking with, and presumably the president is as well. Greg is calling from Roscoe, Illinois. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great, thanks.
Hey, with all due respect to, I believe it was Carl, I hope I got the name right, that was trying to compare this terrorist war to World War II. I'm a former Marine and Vietnam veteran, and in those wars, we had a large coalition of other nations. We don't have that right now, and you know, all due respect, to make that correlation is to me ludicrous, but my whole point and my comment here
yes.
is that when you've got 19 soldiers saying, we're not going, and you have reservists not showing up for their assigned duty.
The 19, you mean the transport unit that refused to take the fuel convoy out a week
exactly.
or two ago?
Exactly. I'm saying that those personnel, they don't even have confidence in the commander-in-chief. And one last comment, and then I'll go, is that if you allow yourself to be bushwashed, you're going to get bushwhacked. And that's a catchphrase I came up with. I'm really proud of
it. Greg, we've got it. David Korn, I want to come to you on this first, and Carla, I'll come to you as well. But here we look at some of these problems on the ground that our caller Greg points out. What's going to make those go away with the election of a John Kerry? He faces a huge challenge there if he inherits this from George Bush. You have not always been entirely supportive of Kerry's position on the war. What makes you think he'll do a better job on the other side of November 2nd if he should win?
Well, I think, in a way, Bush has created a problem for which there is no good, easy, obvious solution. And we certainly don't see one with Bush other than just, you know, persevering and winning and doing all the hard work that he says he puts in. So I start with the premise that, you know, this guy drove us into a ditch with misleading, if not, you know, lying assumptions and assertions, and therefore he doesn't deserve, you know, the keys to the car any longer. You know, I think the Kerry argument, which he can't come out and say on the campaign trail, is essentially, I will muddle through better. You can't put hornets back into a nest after you've broken the nest. You can't put a glass jar together once it's been broken. But I think, you know, the Kerry argument is, if you bring in a new guy who has not alienated so much of our, so many of our allies, and, you know, and who is willing, it seems, to make an effort to try to bring in some Arab nations, which Bush seems really incapable of doing here, that perhaps there's a chance that we can do things better. There's no guarantee of success, and that's one reason I think, you know, we talked about the polls earlier with Andy Kohut,
yeah,
that a lot of the public is dissatisfied with Bush. Over half the public is opposed, now thinks the war was a mistake, but yet, you know, Kerry has not surged ahead.
Right.
And I think part of that is they'd like to even make a promise that I have a 6-point plan that will guarantee success within 2 months, and our troops will be out, and we'll have victory and democracy and freedom in Iraq. And
yeah,
I don't think there's a way that anybody can do that.
Let's get one more call here. Abba is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Abba, you're on the
yes,
air.
Sir, Mr. Cohen says that Mr. Bush was saying that we're going to take them over and we're going to be finished soon. He said the exact opposite at the outset to the nation. This is going to take a long, long time. All I hear from the anti-Bush people is a bunch of statistics. They run from complaint to complaint to complaint. And I would like to hear both from the anti-Bush forces and Mr. Kerry, not just, quote, statistics and complaints. I'd rather hear a solution with a little bit of specifics. So far, I've heard nothing.
But let me ask you, what grade do you give the Bush administration's prosecution of the war so far? How do you...
I think that they've done remarkably well under the most horrible circumstances. I would agree with one of your speakers before, and I would also say that regarding the fact that Mr. Bush is not an intellectual, I'm really not interested in the quasi-pseudo-intellectual for president, nor am I...
I don't think we're going to get hung up on his intellectualism or otherwise, but thank you very much for your call. Carl Zinsmeister, there's a voter who looks out here and sees that long war you describe and says he's on board.
I think there are a lot of them. This is what I'm talking about all around the country today, and there are many people expressing similar views. But I think the interesting thing I'd like to take up is what was just said about what is the Kerry solution. The Kerry solution is some sort of inexplicable ability to talk the French and the Germans and others into helping us out in this war. You know, let me specifically address Greg from Illinois' call, where he said, you know, in the past we always had this big group of helpers with us. That is historically not true. I don't know if you're aware that in the Korean War, for instance, which was an official UN coalition operation, there were 16 nations involved. The U.S. put up 87% of the troops in that war and suffered a similar fraction of the expenses and the casualties.
But President Bush is proud of saying that there's a big alliance, even though some disagree with him. His father was very proud of the big alliance he put together in the Gulf War.
My point is the Korean War, which is the best predecessor example in history, it was almost an identical size coalition and an identical kind of result. That has been the story through the Cold War. That's been the story forever. The idea that the French are going to help us out has just never been the case. For instance, back to Korea, Poland and Ukraine and the Netherlands are each contributing more military personnel to the Iraq War than France contributed back in Korea. France was not helpful in the Cold War at all. This is a complete windmill that John Kerry is tilting against. If he thinks that he's going to talk in people that have never been willing to step up and try to turn history in a less bloody direction, never, ever been willing to expend political will or their own blood or treasure to try to make the world a better place.
So don't be so lonely. David Korn, half a minute left. If it's a Bush re-election, what do you anticipate in Iraq?
More mess. I mean, I'm hoping that that's not the case. I hope that he succeeds. I see no indication that he will. He had no plans before the invasion and what to do after the invasion, and they seem to be ad-hocking it and making it up as they go along. And the current polls from the International Republican Institute show that religious leaders are more likely to win than the interim government that Bush supports if we get to elections. So I think, you know, at best we'll be muddling through.
And with that, we're out of time. David Korn at The Nation, Carl Zinsmeister at The American Enterprise, Peter Boyer at The New Yorker Magazine. Thanks to all three of you for joining us tonight. Listeners, thanks for coming along. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.